Welcome to Biz Rocket Radio with Stone Payton and John Baker. John Baker is a certified financial planner with a Master's of Science in Personal Financial Planning. Certified Financial Planner Board of Standards, Inc. owns the certification mark CFP, Certified Financial Planner, TM and CFP, and in the U.S., which it awards to individuals who successfully complete the CFP board's initial and ongoing certification requirements. John Baker offers financial planning and securities through Woodbury Financial Services, Inc., a registered investment advisor and broker-dealer, member FINRA/SIPC, located at 1050 Crown Point Parkway, Suite 1675, Atlanta, Georgia, 30338. This program is for information purposes only and should not be considered a solicitation of or offer to buy or offer to sell securities or investment advisory services. Information in this program regarding market or other financial information is obtained from sources which are believed to be reliable. We do not warrant or guarantee the timeliness or accuracy of this information. When considering any registered security products, seek a prospectus carefully before you invest. Make sure you consult your financial professional regarding any specific situation. And now, get ready for Biz Rocket Radio. Here's Stone Payton and John Baker.
Welcome to Biz Rocket Radio. We've got a full house in here today, and we are excited about today's show. Stone, I didn't get a chance to talk to you a whole lot. What have you been up to this week? Anything new and exciting going on in your life?
Well, you know what? I booked a real business lunch for Monday afternoon. I'm going to have lunch with our new sponsor, BMA, Business Marketing Association of Atlanta. And as a result of that, for the Monday morning show, the High Velocity Radio Show,
yep.
I think I'm going to be wearing slacks. So I'm just.
Man, I don't know what's going to happen. You're going to break out in hives or something. You're going to have to wear a tie also.
No, that's not going to happen.
Pushing it. It's just pushing it too far. A jacket? Are you going to don don a jacket?
You know, I don't know. You know, I'm getting a little thick in the middle there. So I'm thinking,
it might not fit you.
I got this one loose fitting sweater, and I think I got to get when Holly gets home. She's on the road. When she gets home, I'm going to get her to do the whole Garanimal thing and match up the loose fitting sweater with the right slacks, and then I don't know what I'm going to do about shoes. Like maybe I've got some black Chuck Taylors.
Yeah, the Chucks will work good.
Very excited about this, but it's with our new sponsor. And in fact, I have an announcement about our new sponsor. Again, it's BMA Atlanta, Business Marketing Association of Atlanta, but they have an event coming up, the 7th annual chocolate tasting and charity fundraiser, and it's to benefit Cure Childhood Cancer. And this thing's happening Thursday, February 24th, 6 to 8 p.m. at FAB Atlanta, which FAB stands for French American. You're going to have to help me say this word. Is it brasserie?
I don't know.
I think it means like fancy pastry.
Yeah. Well, you know what? You got chocolate and pastry. That will be a pretty good. A solid event to go from. Right
oh
there.
Man, it's going to be a lot of fun. You know, all the who's who in Atlanta will be there. Advanced registration is only $40. On-site registration is $45, and it's at 30 Ivan Allen Jr. Boulevard. And it's again to benefit Cure Childhood Cancer, and all that's being put on by our new sponsor, BMA Atlanta, Business Marketing Association of Atlanta. So I'm going to wear slacks on Monday, and I don't know. I'm definitely going to be at this event. I don't know what they're going to make me wear at that. Do you have to dress up for those? You go to these things all the time.
I go to them all the time. You're going to probably have to press the slacks one more time and put those to good use. So you'll get two wears out of them in the year, which will be very exciting.
Yeah. So exciting couple of weeks for me. How about you? What you been up to, man?
Last weekend I went, 2 weekends ago, Super Bowl weekend, I went snow skiing out in Steamboat. One of our guests, Frederick also was out there, actually, Winter Park around the same time, but he didn't quite have the same temperatures that we had. It was negative 30 degrees without the wind chill, so it was a little chilly, but it was a blast. And then last weekend, my two boys, Gavin and Jake, and I do a karate style called Yoshikai, and we went down to Pensacola Beach and did a workout on the beach and went in the water and... it was great.
Cool.
It's great.
Yeah.
So we're off and running. That was, it's been my big 2 weekends.
And now you got to work today, man. You have got a studio full of guests. Who all did you bring with you? Who are we going to visit with today?
Well, we're going to start off with Frederick Marks. Frederick is a founder of Key Lingo Translations, and we're just going to get started straight into the gates with Frederick. Frederick, tell us a little bit about yourself and your business.
Great. First of all, thank you very much for having me. It's a pleasure. This is my first time on radio, so I hope I'll speak straight into the mic here. Give me a heads up if I move my head away.
Look, but Alan will slap you if you
okay.
don't. So just
gotcha. Yeah. Well, the field that I'm in is business-to-business professional document translation services. And if you've never heard of this field before, it is a $24 billion industry worldwide. It's around $12 billion here in the United States, and it's growing at a rate of around 13%. So it's a real exciting business to be in. And we always tell our clients, you know, if I had to sum it up in one sentence, we help businesses everywhere do business anywhere.
So language, I'm taking it, is the translation part of what you're doing.
That's correct. An example of a client would be a law firm involved in an international litigation, a company that manufactures a product that wants to sell it around the world, and all of the accompanying documentation needs to be in the local languages of where they're selling that product or service. So it's document translation services.
So do you speak like six different languages yourself? Are you just like a quadlingual?
Well, I still have trouble with English, but I lived in Santiago, Chile for 2.5 years, so I did learn some Spanish.
Stone, did you hear the accent
there?
Oh,
yeah, I picked that up.
You threw that in there to say, don't mess with me, I can speak Spanish.
Imagine the women you could pick up just by being
just
able to
rattle that accent. Yeah.
Well, remember, Chile, the word ends in an E, not an I like the food. So when people say, why are you saying Chile instead of chili, it's the spelling, folks.
Just read it.
That's right.
It works. You don't have to be very fancy.
Great country if you've never visited.
So what kind of languages are there just everyone that's out there you can handle? Or?
Well, we have never been stumped in the 6 years that we've been in business, and we've done over 80 different types of languages, and we have customers that require us to do translations in over 25 different languages. For example, e-learning, for example, a company here in the Metro Atlanta area that produces curriculum for folks that want to move up in the financial services field or insurance fields, and they want that little acronym after their name on their business card. They have to take a class, they have to take an exam, and this company offers these curriculums and programs all over the world, and we're responsible for ensuring that they communicate effectively in all those markets.
Wow, very cool. So what kind of documents, what kind of things are you seeing most that needs to be translated?
Well, we see a lot of web content. You know, if you're a company that has a website, you're an international company whether you like it or not. It's as simple as that.
That's an interesting point, but it's so true. I don't think people really realize that, but what an insightful comment.
That's exactly true. And, you know, the likelihood that you're going to sell your product or service successfully goes up tremendously to the extent that you communicate effectively with those local markets. You know, so companies, you see it all over everywhere, every store you go into, for example, Home Depot, you see the signs in English and Spanish. Rubbermaid is a big client of ours. We do a lot of product descriptions for them. Komatsu out here in Cartersville, they're another one that's selling their earth-moving equipment up in Canada, and they have these big 400-page operating manuals that need to be in French, and we help them with that.
Okay. All right. So when I get that, Panasonic DVD player that's in 16 different languages on the instruction manual, you probably had a hand in that.
If it's good.
If it's good.
If it makes sense, you know, it's a strong likelihood that we did it.
Yeah, when the Japanese stuff, whether it's making sense or not, I'm presuming it does, but you don't really know.
I want that lovely disclaimer of yours at the top of the show. I want that in every language, and that would keep this guy in business for years.
Man, we would never show. All right, so there's the disclaimers, and we've got 2 minutes to interview with our guests real quickly. We'll be done. So what is the most popular language that you've been translating?
Well, Spanish is way up there, and then I would say after Spanish, Chinese, and so lots of Chinese translations going on. As you might imagine, it's a growing economic climate there in China, and lots of products and services being sold from China into the U.S. and from the U.S. into China. And there's lots of other languages as well, but those are two that really rank up high.
Yeah, and what about Japanese? Is that falling down by the wayside nowadays, or is that
not at all? Not at all. It's just not. I wouldn't characterize it as prominent, at least in our business, as the Chinese and Spanish and French, German, things of that nature.
So, how do you go about actually going through the process? If you've got somebody who's wanting the service or needing the service, what would they expect to go through?
Well, first of all, they'd expect to go through what we call the specifications phase of the project. We'd spend a lot of time with the client talking about the project itself. You know, who is the end audience for this translation? Is it an internal audience or is it an external audience? Is it something that is going to portray a corporate image or not? And that will determine a lot the type of detail that you go into. If you have an internal communication, for example, it's probably not as important that you do translation, editing, proofreading by three separate people, because nobody outside of your company is going to see that document. However, if you're involved in a litigation and documents that require translation are going to be filed in a court of law, or you're doing a marketing and advertising translation, you know, the errors and gaffes by companies around the world are the stuff of legend now, where companies have translated things, major companies, and really embarrassed themselves on the world stage. And so you have different types of things. So the first part is where we want to understand the project itself. That's the specifications phase. And then the next phase is the production phase, where we're translating the documents. We also do lots of other things behind the scenes that people don't really understand who are not involved in the industry. For example, we create what's known as a translation memory for every project that we do. And what that is a database of everything that we've translated so that we can reuse previously translated text. And that promotes accuracy and consistency. It speeds up the process over time, and it also drives down costs for our clients. So that's the second phase. You got specifications, and you got production, and then you have the post-production review phase. Like if we were to do something for you, there might be some company-specific or industry-specific terminology that we need to make sure that we capture. And if it's our first project, there's really no way for us to know that. So we go for that review phase where you guys say, okay, guys, great work, but we want to change this and that. And we take it back, we change those things, we put it into our database, and then we close the project and move on down the road.
Very nice. And your business has been in existence since 2004.
Yes,
right?
That's correct.
So you've been around 6 years. I'm going on your seventh year. And how are things going? How's business?
Things are going really great. We're actually in a really interesting phase in our history right now. And I've got to put in a plug for Leslie Cuban at FranNet, yep. who told me about your radio show and has facilitated this opportunity. But we have officially launched the Keylingo franchise system in early January. And so after years in the business of building the infrastructure of the company and building a successful business, what we're up to now is helping other would-be entrepreneurs build a successful business of their own in the translation services industry.
Neat.
Around the
so
country.
You're going global.
We
with
are.
Your translation.
That is the right word for it.
It'd be pretty easy for you to go all those countries because you know exactly how to talk.
Exactly.
To them, right?
Exactly.
Like, how do you You must either have a massive staff of talented people or this is all kind of one-offs. Like you need you need something done and you find someone who's your German person or what have you. How does that work?
It's a very interesting question. You know, the translation industry is structured a lot like Hollywood, for example, okay? So you have your studios, which are your clients at the end of the day. Then you have your agents that are like companies like us. Anybody ever seen Entourage here?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
So you've got your studios. They're the ones making the movies. And in this case, this analogy, those would be the clients. Then you've got your agents, and those are the folks that manage the talent. And in our case, the talent would be the linguists. Okay. So the agents, Keylingo in this case, perform lots of functions. They manage all of the interactions between the studios and the talent. They do lots of back office things. They have lots of core competencies that the studios and the talent don't want to deal with.
Right.
Okay, and so same thing in the translation industry. We have language teams around the world that work with us and work on a project basis. And then we have our own staff. We actually have an office in Argentina that helps us manage all of our projects. And then we have our office here that is the face with the customer.
You're Ari.
That's right.
I am Ari.
I'm Ari.
God.
I'm not quite as mean as he is, but...
You're not quite as blunt as Ari.
That's right. Yeah. That's right.
What a cool business, though. That rocks.
Very cool.
It's really
cool.
Fun. And I really enjoy it.
How did you get the idea for this business? How did it come up?
Well, it's a very interesting story. I originally came to Atlanta from Virginia to go to business school at Emory.
Yep.
And within 3 days of my graduation from Emory in 2001, I was on a plane with my wife, who was 7 months pregnant at the time with our first child, and we moved to Chile, and I was working there. And
I love it when he says Chile.
I know.
And having just dropped a significant sum of money on an education, I had this new toolbox of skills and also this fascination with entrepreneurship that I've had my entire life. And so while I was in Chile, I was thinking about new business ideas and what I was going to do with the next phase of my life. And I was thrust into the position in my role in Chile to actually buy translation services. And what I discovered in that process was it was very difficult for me to find a professional partner in that field. And so while I was in Chile, I no longer work for that company. So I did do a little bit of this on their time, but not too much. I wrote a business plan.
You poached just a little bit.
That's right. But
it happens.
I'll never forget the day I told my wife. She was the second day after giving birth to our second son there in Chile. And I said, you know, Robin, I think I'm going to start this business doing professional document translations for companies. And I still think she was under the anesthesia, but she said, cool.
That was the first time I'd ever pitched her
a business idea, and she actually said, yeah, go for it.
So you knew you had a good business in this already. You're a pitch man already.
That's right.
Convince a wife in one shot. You're good to go.
I convinced her to marry me, first of all, so I'm the best salesman in the world.
I
started the company in 2004 immediately upon my return. And pitched it to some folks who I really respect. And actually, one is on staff now at Keylingo. He's a lawyer at Troutman Sanders, or was one. And now he's our chief legal officer. And so that's where I got the idea for the business, was during my time in Chile.
Very cool.
Yeah.
So I've got to ask this, because you talked about some mess-ups that corporations have done in mixing up translations. Give me a couple of examples of ones that that come to mind that they just said something and that's not what they meant.
I'll give you one that just jumps right in my mind. And by the way, we did not do this.
This is not on you. Okay.
But there was an advertisement by a large airline. I don't know if I can use their name on the air or not. I might get you guys in trouble.
They're probably out of business anyway.
It was American Airlines. Okay,
so they're still around.
And they used the phrase "vuelo en cuero," and that phrase means "fly in leather." Okay, because they had just changed their seats to leather. But in some markets, it meant "fly naked." Okay.
And sales didn't shoot like straight up?
That's right. That's right.
They're like, I'm there.
That's right. That's right. And you can go on Google and type in translation gaffes and you can just get a lot of these, a huge list. You could use them on your show to get laughs, but that's one that pops into my
mind.
That's
a good one. Yeah. Fly naked in leather.
That's right.
So, you know, what could be so wrong?
Sounds comfortable.
That's right. That's excellent.
Just wouldn't want to, I'd want to be the only one. Wouldn't want to.
Yeah,
be the next guy.
No, no, that wouldn't be good. It's kind of like AirTran used to be. What was the name of AirTran before?
AirTran? I always have to ride Greyhound.
Was that People's Express?
You guys are in a whole different league.
What was it? Value Jet. Remember?
Right.
They had fun. You know, they used to have like jokes, and the pilot would come on and be cracking up, and this and that, and that was how they got the whole market until they crashed in the Everglades, and then things went downhill from there. Yeah.
No more Value Jet.
No more Value Jet. I think we'll keep it in the air and get it back down to reality. Well, that's great. So, tell us a little bit about what motivates you? As a business owner, and obviously things are rolling, and you're now transitioning it into the next thing. A lot of our listeners out there, our business owners, our executives, what is the thing that gets you up in the morning and gets you fired up?
Sure. Well, other than my 7 and 9 year old boys that get me out of bed every single morning, I would say the one thing that keeps me going is this culture of constant improvement and innovation that we have inbred at Keylingo. That's one of the things that I learned in business school, is that if you want to have a successful business, you have to be tireless in your efforts to continuously differentiate your business from the competition. And that's what gets me up every morning, is being part of that creative, that innovative process. And I think that we've achieved that at Keylingo. You know, we're the first company in our space to do a comprehensive effort at franchising our business in the translation space. And so right now we're right on the, we've only recently launched it, and it's just a really, really exciting time. And that gets me up every single day. And just having created something from nothing and have it be successful, it's hard not to get up every morning and get jazzed about that. And that's that really keeps me going every day.
Cool. Very good. Very good. So one of the things I like to kind of finish up with is asking my guests about giving a pearl of wisdom, something that you've learned in your experiences through business that has made you successful or made other people successful that you've seen kind of implement it. What would it be?
Man, this one is not hard at all. It just, I preach this to folks that I know, and I try to live my life this way. There's a phrase that is pretty well known. Maybe you've heard it before. It's, what's down in the well comes up in the bucket. And what that means is what you put in your head is what actually comes out in your business dealings, in your personal dealings, dealings with your family, your friends. What's down in the well comes up in the bucket. And if you read a really great book, Tony Dungy's book, Uncommon, he actually talks about this in his book. And it's something that I try to live my life by. I try to surround myself with other positive people that want to be successful. And my friends, my personal relationships, my relationship with my wife and my children. You just have to watch what you put in your head. Watch, you know, turn off the TV, read something positive, surround yourself with other positive people that are looking to make an impact, and it will rub off. It'll be contagious, and it'll happen for you as well.
Very good. Stone, I don't think I've heard that one yet.
I haven't, but you're going to hear it more, and I'm going to pass it off as my own, because I think that sounds like a Stoneism, right?
Yeah, absolutely, it is. This guy comes in the studio every day, like same way you see him right now. It's not a show.
And before we let you go, I want to hear, you have such a sexy tagline. You mentioned it at the top of the show.
Yes.
Can you mention that again, and make sure that our listeners know how to get in touch with you?
Absolutely. The name of the company is Keylingo. Our website is keylingo.com. And our slogan is that we help businesses everywhere do business anywhere.
That rocks.
Perfect. All right. Well, I know that you are off to the airport, so you're not going to be able to hang out for a little bit. Well, we appreciate having you on, and look forward to catching up with you maybe in the year. Maybe get an update on how things are going with a franchise kickoff.
It's really great to be here, John. I really appreciate the opportunity, and all the best to you, and I hope I do get the chance to come back and talk to you again.
Thank you, Frederick. All right, so our next guest is Frank Harris, and Frank is with MP Learning. He is a chief marketing and sales officer there. Frank, how have you been?
I'm doing great. I'm glad to be here, John.
Well, tell us a little bit about your background and maybe a little bit about MP Learning.
Well, first of all, thanks. I've never done a radio show, but this is pretty exciting, and it's kind of hard to follow Frederick with the way he was throwing his lingo around.
You know, these multilingual guys, you know, you just
unbelievable.
Gotta, you can't, yeah.
Unbelievable. Well, NP Learning is a consulting and training company that deals in the innovation or new product development space. We are grounded in the way we like to go to business, and the way we talk and try and differentiate ourselves is that we deal with best practices that have actually been based or researched to actually work. We don't deal with fads. We're not into the latest and greatest idea unless that idea has actually been proven to work for companies to improve their new development process.
So how did you get started with MP Learning?
That's a very interesting question, because as I look back and reflect on my life, I probably was destined to work for a company like NP Learning. And the way I actually ran into the founder, Ken Westray, was I was in the middle of transition. I had just shut down a business that I had started with a partner in the restaurant franchising area, and I was looking for my next gig. And after a lot of soul searching, I ran into Ken at a meeting or networking meeting called Product Camp, and we just hit it off. And lo and behold, he said he needed somebody that had my background, and I jumped on board. And I'm always a risk taker, so it worked out very well for me.
And how long have you been with NP Learning?
I've been with them almost 2 years now. I started in 2009, and it's just been one heck of a ride. It's been a very interesting time in my life because I've been able to translate what I've learned throughout my career into actually helping companies and people improve their ability to launch and design and develop new products.
Well, tell us a little bit more about that. I mean, 20 years as a professional, bringing that experience to NP Learning, what do you think are the main things that you brought into the organization that are important?
Well, when I look back at my life, and I think that everybody needs to at some point take an assessment of what are they passionate about, what really motivates them, what makes them want to even do the job that they're doing. And for me, I always was involved in situations where they would say, hey, let's do this. But nobody had an idea how to do it.
Right.
But they had an idea that they wanted to do it. And for me, it just sort of started to come natural of, well, this is what we have to do if we're going to do that. And it really started with my family life. My parents always expected us to and gave us responsibilities without necessarily saying this is the way you have to do that, but this is what you have to accomplish. Hmm. And if you failed, they wanted it to be a learning experience. So failure was not punished. And to me, that's what's important even in your business life, is not to punish people that try new things or take on responsibilities. And that sort of infuses myself. So I'm willing to take risk, and I'm willing to take ownership in these new ideas. I don't shy away from them. I don't have to be in a comfort zone. And what I bring to NP Learning is a history of working for General Electric and their new product area. And an interesting sidebar there is the month that I started with GE was the same month that Jack Welch took over as chairman. And
you and Jack turned that whole thing around, didn't you?
Absolutely. I mean, in fact, he grabbed a lot of my ideas. But
right.
I
don't know whichever way
I would
it went.
Say I was more involved in implementing his, and being an outsider coming in, I got to see the dynamic of the disruption that he was causing for the old line GE employees. To me, they were great ideas, and I still subscribe to a lot of those. But that leads to the empowerment of people, which I think is ultimately the essence of what makes good companies.
What do you think are some of the attributes that lead companies to have a product that just doesn't make it, that just doesn't work out the way it really could?
Well, first let me say it that it's really only been about the last 10 years that this whole body of knowledge of what it makes a successful company around new product development has sort of been put into a tried and true system. And it's what is important is that there are really six key components to being successful in this area. And it all starts with strategy. I mean, if you don't have a business strategy, then you can't have a new product strategy. And you need to make sure that those are in sync. There's also this area of portfolio management, which is what products are you in or what markets are you in?
Right.
And then how do you meet those? Then there's the area of, is there a process? How do you vet the new ideas that you have to see if they're successful? And that's where a lot of companies fall down. Teams and organizations, market research. It's all part of it. And then you need to have a way of measuring it, the tools and metrics. So where most companies will fail in this whole area is that they don't kill ideas early enough. They have more ideas than are really valid or really in line with their company. So they don't have a way of fleshing those out and making them into good ideas. And then they waste resources, they waste time, they waste effort.
So they're spreading themselves too thin, really, instead of focusing on a few areas that are primary.
Or we've probably all been there where we had the boss that always has the great idea that he throws at you from, he wrote it down in a bar, you know, and you go, well, that's an interesting idea. But because he's the boss, you spend time on it and it fails because you haven't done all of those steps that you need to.
So how do you manage that, though, in terms of you want to continue to cultivate an innovative culture, right? So how do you manage the fact that you've got me and Alan and John and Reggie and everybody, we're giving you all these ideas, and you have to exercise the discipline of killing them quickly. So how do you keep us engaged if our ideas keep getting shut down? There must be some dance to that. Speak to that, if you will.
Yeah, well, it's actually easier than it may seem. My philosophy, which I think comes from my experiences, which is the way all of us are, is that you need to empower people. And empowering people is all about how do you lead those people. And the way I like to empower people is I like to let them know what the strategy is, but let them participate in why that's the strategy and gain an understanding of why that's the strategy. So what you're trying to do is you're trying to get those people to take some ownership in their job and their part of the company. And that way, the ideas that you bring to me, you've already kind of vetted those ideas into, because you have an understanding of what is required or what is the way we make decisions. But I love to have you bring ideas, and I never kill an idea or I never kill a new process without it being vetted by the group. So you have to have a procedure. You have to have a way of making those decisions.
Well, that makes sense. And I'm thinking, if you really are successful in creating that kind of environment, then I'm more emotionally invested in the big picture than I am just my little idea. So that makes a lot of sense.
Yeah. And really, that was Jack Welch's philosophy at GE, because he articulated it a couple of ways. And one of the ways he articulated is you need to be number one or number two in your market, or you're out of here. You're not part of GE. And it sounds harsh when you think about it. It sounded harsh, but what he was really saying is you need to consider who you are and what your company is and what your point of value is. Because if you have no value, how are you going to have customers? How are you going to be successful?
John, we're one or two in our market, right, man?
I mean, I think we just got to one. Just got to one. I think the other one is gone now.
Right.
So I think we're one.
Cool.
We're there. We have the highest audience of anybody.
At this studio on
this
Wednesday
time.
Quit saying
morning.
One, though, because that sounds like an audience of one. But
oh, sorry. Yeah, no, can't say that. So tell me about organizations or companies that would be a good fit for you and MP Learning.
Well, the good news about MP Learning is that we're pretty much agnostic on what the type of company it is, because the principles and the methods and the best practices apply whether you're in a service business or whether you're a hard good manufacturer, whether you're a nonprofit. Let's back up and think about that for a minute. The reality is that to be successful, you need to make money. And people will say, well, nonprofits don't need to make money. Well, that's not true. If they are going to grow their ability to service the clients thereafter, they need to raise more funding. That is profitability for them. So it's not how you define, you know, it's how you define profitability. All right. So the important part in my mind is to make sure that is understood by every employee, that we're out here to make money, and that's what defines success. But it has to be how do I serve the needs of my customers? Because you have to be very customer oriented. And again, Welch being number one and number two, what he's saying is you better be servicing your customers, but you also have to understand who they are.
Right. And in your experience, how has that helped translate with other organizations that have taken that road and been able to kind of make that turn, make that shift to being successful?
Well, the organizations. Let me back up and answer the second part of your question, which is what companies. Size is not as important. We don't necessarily like to deal with startup companies because they don't necessarily have the funding to do that. So we might mentor them personally, but we go after companies, whether it's Fortune 500 or divisions of Fortune 500s. Usually they find us when they've had a failure and they want to know why they failed. And right. We have a whole assessment way of going after them.
Right. Right. Let's shift gears mm-hmm. here, because I know in reading your bio, it looks like you've done a lot of work with foster care and foster children.
Oh, yeah.
Tell me a little bit about that experience.
Well, it really kind of reinforces my philosophy of the empowerment of people. People are what's important in the grand scheme of things. That's what makes organizations, families, you name it, successful. Foster children, for some people, don't realize that they're sort of the forgotten children within our society. There are about 15,000 foster kids in Georgia. May sound like a big number, may not. It depends on how you
look
at that.
Sounds like a big number to me.
Well, it is a big number when you look at it from the standpoint of there's enough families, there are enough people in Georgia when we're 6-7 million people to take those children in.
Right.
But my wife, the angel in my life, she sort of led our family to, we're going to become foster parents.
Really?
And she did this when my sons were younger. And part of it was to counteract the fact that we lived in East Cobb in a society where money, goods, status was what was important. And she wanted to counteract that whole philosophy that they were going through living in, going to school in East Cobb. So we started doing foster care, and we had about 8 children over about a 6-year time frame. And it opened my eyes and our family's eyes as to, number one, there are some deep-seated reasons why there are foster children. But number two, just inserting yourself into that child's life will make a difference at some point within their life. Currently, what I'm doing is, because the boys are grown, they're out of the house. My wife is a teacher and teaches, she teaches kids with learning disabilities. Dyslexia is the main issue. But I'm part of a group that mentors foster teenagers. And here's an interesting statistic. In Georgia, only about 61% of high school students actually graduate from high school. And that's probably an eye-opening number to everybody.
That's a scary 61%. Statistic.
Right. Now, that doesn't mean they don't go back and get a GED at some point. But 61%, a kid in foster care, that number's been pegged at somewhere around 15% of them will graduate or even get their GED. If you insert a mentor into their life, and that's just somebody that they can talk to, somebody that they can go to with problems, somebody that puts a little bit of expectation, I'm expecting you to graduate from high school, just giving them some structure, but somebody that's reliable, that doesn't run away from them, because you have to think about these kids have already been scarred with being let down by authority figures. Yeah. As long as you're consistent, that number can go up to 70%.
Wow.
And that's a huge gain with actually a little bit of effort on the part of anybody that wants to make an impact in our society.
Wow. Good stuff. What and in all those eight kids that you were did foster mm-hmm. care for, mm-hmm. Did you have any memories of them coming? Did they come back? Did they ever talk to you afterwards, or was there any communication with that?
The foster care system is very very unique in that there's a separation between the foster family and the family he comes from for security reasons, you name it.
Yeah.
There's also, once the kid is put back into or their case is rectified, and that rectification can come from they're placed with another family member that has the wherewithal to take care of them and is not going to abuse them, because abuse is typically the issue. Or they get adopted. So if you think about the fact that we did this, and the last foster child we had was in 2002, we did younger foster children. That child is now about 12 years old. We have no clue as to where he is. Well, right. We do know where he is, but we have not had any contact. And that's done for the reason of allowing the child to reintegrate, because we had that particular boy for 2 years.
And oh,
we,
wow.
We even thought about adopting him at the time.
Yeah.
But fortunately, he was put back with his brothers in a family situation with another relative, and that was a good outcome.
Yeah. Well, thank you for that. That's great information. I hadn't looked into the foster care piece. I had some friends who had done it in the past, but that's neat to
hear.
There is a
group. I don't remember the exact name, but it's being hosted within churches within the area, where they're really trying to get the churches to start building support systems around foster care,
mm-hmm.
And that's helping. That's really helping Georgia a lot in that area.
Great. Well, God love you for doing that. And prior to this interview, my knowledge of the foster care system was confined to the movie I saw again last night, Four Brothers, which is a great movie.
Not they, too detailed, though.
And well, they were very bonded. I got to say, those four brothers were very bonded.
Before we decided as a family to do it, we actually showed, our boys were young at the time, they were elementary school age, and we showed them Angels in the Outfield, and that's about foster kids.
Nice.
And that way they were able to relate when we said, and we're going to bring a foster child into our home. You know, right. And there's some issues.
So how did you live up to the whole Danny Glover image? That must have been a hard act to follow. Wouldn't you love to have Danny Glover as a foster father?
I'm more like Christopher Lloyd, you know.
Well, let's move on to the kind of our last question,
sure.
Which is kind of appropriate at this point. What would your pearl of wisdom be to our listeners from a business perspective, and things that you've seen that have helped make people successful?
It's really simple for me. It's the ability to take ownership, and that doesn't just mean that I own this thing. It means that I own what I do, that I am responsible for my actions, that I make sure that what I contribute is morally correct, my integrity is there, that ownership to me infuses throughout life. And it's in the case of what my wife did with the fosters, she took ownership in being part of helping others. And that's really what I infuse in my employees. And when I owned the restaurant and was in that franchising business, very difficult business, but I quickly learned that if I empower those people and give them some ownership within making it happen, and part of that ownership is they get paid better, but they have some security, it's just proven to work so well for me and make me successful in my life.
Well, that's great. That's been educational and eye-opening. I appreciate your time, Frank. If somebody wants to get in contact with you, either with NP Learning or something about foster kids, how could they get in contact with you?
Yeah, it's real easy. For NP Learning, it's www.n, like Nancy, Paul, learning, learning.com, and just send an email to frank@nplearning.com.
Simple.
Love to hear from anybody.
Nice and straightforward. Well, we appreciate you having you. And great job. First time on the radio.
Thank you.
Yeah, you'd have never known that, man. You're a natural.
You're a pro.
You want John's job?
No, not really.
Pay is not very good. You need to increase my pay here. All right. So our next guest is Lawrence Martin. And Lawrence has brought a guest, Reginald Shorter. And Lawrence is the president and CEO of One World Educational Solutions Group. Lawrence, welcome in.
Hey, John. How are you? I appreciate you having us on.
My pleasure. You've been waiting for a little bit. I appreciate
patient
your patience.
Guy, right?
He's been nice, been sitting back here and learning all this great stuff.
Absolutely. It's hard to follow up behind these guys here. You know, hopefully we can do justice. They've done a great job and a lot of information.
Yeah. So tell us, Lawrence, a little bit about your background and where
sure.
you come from.
So, hey, I'm Lawrence Martin. I'm actually from Boston. Been down in Atlanta about 13, 14 years. A IT professional of about 26 years. Started out in the military in the Air Force, writing programs as normal IT people grow up, as we call it. And started One World Education about a year ago, actually building it out. Started a business plan about almost 2 years ago. So it took quite a while for us to kind of think about it. And when I say yes, my wife and I, her pushing me along, saying, yeah, you should do it, kind of, I'd go to her and say, hey, how do we do this? You know, right. Should we do this? And, you know, when you talk yourself out of it, she says, well, you know, you'll kick yourself later if you don't. So you might as well see it through and just kind of build the business plan. It doesn't cost you anything but brain power.
Mm-hmm.
And I think what really pushed me along was really kind of a testament what Frank was actually talking about, which is kind of interesting. I'm actually one of those products of a foster home as well.
Really?
Yeah, actually. Absolutely. My mother, and when I was about 13, I was actually adopted out.
Wow.
So it's kind of interesting that we can, you know, with proper guidance and with folks helping you along, you can actually be, you know, be successful, and those things that held you back before won't actually hold you back going forward. So, you know, and that's kind of one of the things that we've tried to do at One World is really we're building a product and a solution that actually helps organizations, colleges, universities to enable the education experience. The reason the company's called One World is that we actually believe that education transcends the local area, those four walls, that traditional university setting that you generally see in every community. We actually believe that education transcends that, and it's actually anyone in the world should have access to a very well put together educational solution as we have here in North America and the United States.
So are there examples of universities? I know that groups around the country that kind of do that now, but they seem to be institutions that are just trying to branch out and have more students. Is that what this is about, or is it something different?
Yes and no. So it's actually about that being able to enable those institutions. So we build a platform. You may have been hearing, you know, if you've been watching any television, the commercials, you know, off to the cloud by Microsoft. But
right.
what we actually do is we build a cloud-based application. In layman's term, it's basically a destination point.
Right.
So the application lives out in a destination somewhere else other than in your organization. And you have access to that application, and all of your students, learners, listeners, anyone out there has access to those applications remotely. But the universities are actually trying to do two things. One, they're trying to broaden their horizon, so by going after a different demographic of students. When we had this real big economic downturn, one of the things that really happened is that many of those folks who were in transition realized that they need to retool. And one of the things that we all realized is that a 40-year-old man who's just been working for the last 20 years is not and has a family, and he's not just going to be able to walk out the door and say, okay, I'm now going to go to a university setting, drop everything, and just go pay
right.
50, 60 grand to go back to school. So we have to reach those folks in a different way with a different medium.
Mm.
And that's what the universities and colleges are trying to do on one side of it. The other side, it is actually a big revenue boost for them as well. And so one of the things is that if you can, you know, it's much cheaper to actually deliver this type of learning remotely, you know, when you really think about the CapEx cost and so forth. But, you know, this is actually another medium. I think the conversation that we've all had in the past of if people will actually accept virtual education has already been answered. Now it's just when your organization is going to be accepting it. It's no longer the if question.
Right.
Well, I have an experience to share with you that might have some bearing on this. My father has a terminal degree as a doctorate, and he was a superintendent of schools for a large system. And in his retirement, he's an adjunct professor for a local university. And he is really known for teaching this one class. And, you know, he's the guy. If you want to pass the certification, you got to take it from Pete Payton. And when they first came to him with all this e-learning stuff, he really poo-pooed it. No, I got to be there. And I guess it's taken about a year for him. But now he teaches the class virtually, and you can just see him beam with pride when he talks about his students in Italy. And so he has to, I mean, he has turned 180 degrees, and I think what he's done is found a way to also do blend some of the live learning with it, too.
Sure enough.
But he's like one, the biggest fan of this stuff.
Absolutely. So that's kind of what I fashion as the global ecosystem, so the new global educational ecosystem. So much like what we have in business, you're doing business here, but all of the transactions are happening in another part of the world. If you call your credit card company today, who's going to pick up the line? Somebody probably in India or the Philippines, Korea, somewhere. So that's kind of that business ecosystem that transcends your local area. That's the same thing with education. So what your father has done is actually created his own ecosystem for his class. He's now delivering that class to people in China and Italy and other parts, far parts of the world that he would have never been able to touch if he just said, I'm going to do this in a traditional fashion behind the four walls of a traditional university.
So is your organization, is it where somebody would go to your website and actually find these classes, or are you going to universities and building the infrastructure for those kinds of classes?
So we actually work with the universities, colleges, and organizations. So we have a big business organizations as well that are looking to offer online or virtual education. Mm-hmm. But we work with the institutions. They own that IP. So what those institutions are known for is their great IP, their great knowledge that those professors pull forward and teach. And so what we do is work with them to build those, create them, whether they're in a PowerPoint fashion or a video fashion, whichever medium they want to use. And we actually deliver that for them across the internet. They use our platform, our infrastructure to deliver it. But as a student, you will never know it's our organization delivering it because mm-hmm. it's fully branded, fully localized to that organization. We want to make sure that that organization's experience is actually pushed forward, not ours. We want to enable the organization.
So you're basically the guys on the ground doing the work, making sure that everything happens, and they're the ones that are producing the content and giving you the information that's needed, and then they're bringing the people to you that want to take these classes or get this education.
Yeah, in its simplest form, yes. So what happens is like you have in most organizations and most colleges, you go to your registrar's office and you sign up for a class. In this case, you'd be signing up for a virtual class. And you, when that class has the same structure as a normal class, so it has times that it meets, but in this particular case it's virtual, that time is any time. The new classroom is your bedroom, it's your living room, it's the park bench, it's the bus. That becomes your new classroom because that content is already prepared and ready to go for you at any time that you need it, 24/7, 365.
Yeah. If there's executives, business owners listening, and they're thinking through, you know, what would I need this for? I mean, I can understand being a college or a university, but give me some examples
sure.
of where a business might want to use something like this.
So there's lots of them, and a lot of the larger businesses have already taken advantage of virtual education. The first thing is that you're talking about cost cutting here, cost reduction. It's not functional, it's not effective for an organization to bring everyone from around the world to one room to teach them,
right.
say, the normal ethics training that we all must take every year. So bringing in an organization.
Alan had to take it three times. The ethics, yeah. I know
he kept failing. He just kept not, that questions, he couldn't understand that. What does that mean? Not sure.
He paid me to take the third one.
That's ethical.
Yeah.
But using our tool, what they will be able to do is extend that education to anywhere in the world. And being able to manage it. We have tools that are built in that kind of help you monitor whether it's the right student taking the taking the course and presenting that information. We can block certain content from there. We can push test questions back and forth to the university, to the business in this case here. So we have a lot of those tools that help enable the organizations out there to be able to deliver all types of educational things. So you think about an accounting practice. Somebody's looking to broaden out their accounting firm. Well, there are lots of new practices, gap practices that come out. Well, you definitely can't send your students all across the country. It becomes extremely expensive to put them on planes, to put them in hotels and feed them in rental cars and so forth. So what you can do is deliver that education virtually. And you think about that. You know, you can deliver that one piece of education virtually to many people. And
yeah.
they're all getting the same content, so it's not going to be getting a different brand of the content.
It's consistent. It's
exactly.
The instructor's at his best or her best. You know, that's what a great way to. What kind of mistakes do organizations and maybe even universities make if they try to pull this off on their own and they don't get the benefit of seasoned, experienced counsel like from you guys?
Well, the first thing is that we often say that educational institutions need to be in the business of educating and not in the business of technology. And so we actually move faster in the technology space than they will. They're slow adopters in the education field. And there's nothing wrong with that. It's just they want to make sure they've got tried and true practices. In the technology space, we actually want to be on the bleeding edge. We want to be looking at what's the latest and greatest technologies to deliver content. So when you think about it now, this the big streaming, about 10 years ago, you would probably want to sit down and watch a movie and it'd take you about 10 hours to watch it because it continued to buffer. Well, with the technology, it's finally caught up with the demand. And so now you can sit down and watch that three-hour movie and, stream straight through, and you won't get these pauses in between, and you won't have these wait and stop periods. So this is a big push you see in other areas, people like Netflix actually streaming online now. So you're seeing that the demand for technology has caught up. And so technology is now leading the way, helping them to kind of influence that.
Where are you seeing the majority of your activity coming from? Is it coming from the business side that wants to educate employees and have these little, like Stone said, ethics programs, that kind of thing? Or is it really coming from the universities?
I see it in our space, it's coming from the universities in really a very specific segment in the universities where it's starting at. As if there are a lot of executive programs now being offered at every university, and I call them boutique programs. And what these are is you have the executive MBA programs, executive this type of certificate, learning certificates, all these different certificates, very, very expensive. And one of the big things that they're doing is they're actually using hybrid. So part of that is delivered in person, and then part of it's delivered virtually. The challenge is that they don't really have maybe the necessary tools to deliver those virtual pieces. And that's how we actually created our tools. That I actually was taking an online class about 2 years ago. And when I sat down and I looked at it, and I said, wow, this tool that they were using, extremely inefficient. I mean, the streaming was horrible. The content was horrible. The way they uploaded, the only good thing about it is we could email. But we could do that from any tool.
Yeah.
So we didn't really need them. And the university was actually positioning that as their go-to tool. And I looked at that and I said, wow, somebody could actually build something better. And that somebody just happened to be me.
Good for you. Wow.
And so that's how we came
to innovation. What an inspiring story.
That's good. So what makes you guys different? There's got to be a ton of people in your space. What makes you different?
The first thing is that we actually concentrate on the user experience. And so many of the organizations in our space, there really aren't that many. If you really think about it, there are probably three or four types of segments in our space. There's the big behemoths out there that actually support both the organizations and these huge colleges and so forth. But the problem is that they're using 20-year-old technologies.
Well, and they haven't been on Biz Rocket Radio.
There you go.
That is true.
So we're actually catching them today.
There you go.
You just passed them. I don't know if you heard that. That was you passing your competition. Right there.
My heart started pounding.
I know. It happens a lot.
But that's actually good, though, that we're getting our message out there, and BizRocket's actually really enabling us to get that message out there. There are other options. The other big thing that differentiates us from this is that with the user experience, what we actually are doing is we're actually presenting our tools in a way that makes it efficient for the user, for the student to actually take the classes. So we have patent-pending technologies that we've already processed and is going through the government. As you know, it's a kind of a slow boat ride across. But the process is working for us, and we've been told that things look good for us and that we'll get those patents out here hopefully really soon. But these patents really, what they do is enable the student to actually learn better, capture that data, and then recall it later. So you think about simple things like if you're watching a video online, how many times have you been in front of an instructor and that instructor keeps talking while you're trying to take a note? That's never happened to anyone but me. But
could you just be quiet for a second while I take this note? Hold up for the rest of the class because I need to. Yeah.
Exactly. So when you're doing it in a virtual world, it actually has the same effect. You're trying to actually listen to this, but the professor, their streaming video is continuing to go. What we build into ours is what we call a virtual notebook. And what this virtual notebook is, as you begin to type your notes, the actual session actually pauses, allows you to take that note.
Automatically. You don't have to hit the pause button. And
No. That's old technology.
Wait, well, that's old school. Come on, man.
That deserves a patent. That rocks.
Well, the best part about it is that once you actually get done, you actually hit the save button. It actually copies that data to what we call a virtual notebook. And as you continue through the sessions, it catalogs all of those notes that you've taken, and it links them back to where you were in the video. So when you need to recall it,
wow,
you just click on a button, and it rewinds the video to where you were when you took that note if you need to get more information.
Now, that piece has to be exciting. That's exciting part.
Reginald's here.
Hey,
Reg. What's going on, man?
I'm doing okay.
You've been quiet over there. Well, he's you taking know, your thunder.
Well, Lawrence, he's a very good orator. He's speaking very well about the company, so I'm letting him have his right.
You're the tech guy, aren't you?
No, I'm the educator.
You're the educator. Yeah, okay. Educator, all right. Well,
so how did you two guys get together on this? Give us the backstory. You gave us a little bit of the backstory for you, Lawrence. But, yeah, give us a little backstory, Reginald.
Well, one day in the middle of church, Lawrence approached me and said, Reg, I'm thinking about creating this product. I want you to get on and let me present it to you. So after several conversations, we talked about the online experience, how it's so inefficient that students need to be in a free learning environment, intuitive and interactive. The key is interactive. Most online education programs, they're not interactive. They're more like a storage clearinghouse. So we decided to develop a program that gives the students more interactive experience, the instructor and the administrator as well.
Right. So, and have you been on since the beginning? You started off with them, right? Right out of the gates, huh?
Yes.
All right. Well, good.
It's been
start.
A fun ride too.
That's right. Just starting.
Yes.
Buckle your seatbelt, man.
Well, this is the high mark today. Hey, we're on video. Come on.
Passed the entire competition.
There you go. There you go.
Well, that's great. You know, I wanted to circle back around, Lawrence. I had a question for you. That kind of goes back to the pearl of wisdom, but I'm going to change it a little bit because I was really. Interested to hear about your background, about you growing up, and obviously that must have been a very difficult process to go through, and a way to grow up with all those different changes going on. Well, how did you pull yourself up by your bootstraps? What do other people need to do that are coming from maybe situations that aren't as, you know, East Cobb or North Fulton ish, and be successful?
I think the first thing is believe in themselves. So that's the first thing you have to do. You absolutely have to believe in yourself. And more importantly, from my growing up, it was pretty tough in Boston, pretty tough environment. But I think that I had, you know, first of all, God was on my side. And so he looked out after me. And I truly believe in that proverb where he wouldn't put more in me than I could bear. And so I kind of went with the stride. And I always believed that there was something more out there for me. And the one thing that probably kind of moved me along more than anything else is I was in high school getting ready to graduate, and we had these people in our schools called guidance counselors. I don't know if they still have those or not.
I had them back in my day.
Yeah, I don't think they have them anymore.
They still exist.
Well, still got them?
Yes.
They might need to start relooking at that, but at least when I was in.
Maybe hire a few more. So.
Yeah. Well, this gentleman actually told me he said, what do you want to do when you graduate? I said, I want to go into computers. Love computers, had already done programs, wrote programs for the school, the high school I was in.
Wow.
And I said, wow, okay, I'd love to do that. And he looked at my transcript and he says, don't think that's going to happen for you. Forgot to take this one math class. And here I am, you know, just sitting back saying, wow, couldn't be. It just couldn't be. And he told me, he said, why don't you think about a trade school or something? You're really good with your hands. Why don't you think about that?
Come on. Really?
Really? Really?
That's and so, good guidance. That's nice. Aspire.
There you go. So the thing that really kind of changed me is I left there, and the school actually had recruiters in a couple of days later. Walked into the gymnasium. Recruiters are all in there. The Marines are in there, and they're all dressed up looking great, and swords are going, and people are just tagging around and wanting to touch their coats. You had the Army had a rock climbing wall there. Everybody wanted to go try the rock climbing wall. The Navy guys had, you know, pictures of their ships and, you know, little models there, and I was like, wow. And I looked over, and the Air Force guy was sitting there with a name banner on the front of his table, had a cup of coffee and a newspaper. So I walk over to him and I ask him, I said, you know, say, are you one of the recruiters? And he peeled back his paper, looked at him and said, hey, how you doing? Introduced himself, went back to reading. And I said, well, you're not
nice
trying to get
skills,
people to
right?
come. And he says, well, I'm not really going to compete with that. He said, because we believe in the Air Force. This is the kind of drug that sells itself. We don't have to put on games. We don't have to dress up. We don't have to do all these other things. If you want a career and you want a skill that's going to transcend everything you're doing right now, come and see me at my office. And I went down to his office. He gave me a pretest, and he said, walked back in. He said, what did you say you wanted to do again? I said, really wanted to get into computers. And the guidance counselor told me that I couldn't. And he looked at me, and he said, well, based on what you scored on this test, I'll let you be a computer engineer in my Air Force. How's that sound to you? And I was like, are you serious? And he's like, yeah, let's do it. And so about 2 weeks after I graduated high school, I went into the Air Force and became a programmer immediately.
Wow.
And then after that, I just, you know, the wheels kept going for me. And one of the pearls of wisdom that I have is that when they say you can't do it, you have to prove them wrong and yourself right. So you have to prove them wrong and yourself right whenever you do. Whatever it comes to, against you, you have to prove them wrong and prove yourself right. And that goes a long way. I've always been in that mode of when they said I couldn't do it, I went ahead and said to myself, I can. You know, so, and I truly believe in the idea that this journey that I'm on is not a destination. It's truly a journey.
Great. Well, it's been a pleasure, Lawrence. And if people want to get in contact with you guys, what's the best way to do that?
They can give us a ring at 770-638-4739. They can reach us on our website at www.theworldeducationsolutions. Or they can actually email me at lawrence.martin@theworldeducation.com.
All right, and we'll have that all up on our website here at Biz Rocket Radio. Well, guys, we really appreciate you coming in and spending the time. We had a great time learning more about everything that you guys are doing, and much respect to both of you, and hopefully we'll have you back on here checking up with you guys to see how things are going in the next several months.
I appreciate it. Thank you.
Thanks a lot.
All right.
Thanks.
John Baker is a certified financial planner with a Master's of Science in Personal Financial Planning. Certified Financial Planner Board of Standards, Inc. owns the certification mark CFP, Certified Financial Planner, TM and CFP, and in the U.S., which it awards to individuals who successfully complete the CFP Board's initial and ongoing certification requirements. John Baker offers financial planning and securities through Woodbury Financial Services, Inc., a registered investment advisor and broker-dealer, member FINRA, SIPC, located at 1050 Crown Point Parkway, Suite 1675, Atlanta, Georgia 30338. This program is for information purposes only and should not be considered a solicitation of or offer to buy or offer to sell securities or investment advisory services. Information in this program regarding market or other financial information is obtained from sources which are believed to be reliable. We do not warrant or guarantee the timeliness or accuracy of this information. When considering any registered security products, seek a prospectus carefully before you invest. Make sure you consult your financial professional regarding any specific situation. We'll be right back.